Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. Episode 281, the Boers anoint Dinizulu as King of the Zulus after Cetshwayo Khampande dies suspiciously. Cetshwayo had sought refuge in Nkandla as his arch-enemy Zibebu turned his attention to the royalists living along the Zululand coastal plain. Soon, Somkeli of the Umphokunyoni and the Imangweni people were hiding in the swamps and reed beds of the subtropical bush along the Indian Ocean. Melmoth Osborne was the resident commissioner of Zululand and a committed foe of Cetshwayo's royal line, a supporter of Zibebu. As Cetshwayo waited for the civil war to die down, he came to the conclusion that it was imperative to convince Melmoth of his right to rule. It was time to come out of hiding and seek shelter from the commissioner, which he did under Henry Francis Finn Jr.'s escort in October 1883. Cetshwayo was placed in a small house alongside his father's old Kwaqikaza homestead, where he could contemplate how far he'd fallen. There Cetshwayo remained until 8th of February 1884. Had he lived longer, he would have heard that his old Induna and counselor, Mnyamana, had escaped with his life after being poisoned. The Zulu king was not going to be so fortunate. Shortly after lunch at 2:30 p.m. on the 8th of February, he was overtaken by convulsions. Then he collapsed and died a short while later. His family members refused permission for a post-mortem. Surgeon Scott declared the death caused by heart disease. However, historians believe Cetshwayo had most likely been poisoned. The poison placed either in his beer or his snuff. While it's not known what poison was used, research into the symptoms and passage of death points to Erythrophyllum lacianthum, commonly known as the Swazi ordeal tree. It's a large tree native to southern Africa. It is notable for its exceptionally toxic bark and seeds, traditional cultural significance and ecological value, and can be found in forests across parts of South Africa, Eswatini and Mozambique. All parts of this tree, the Swazi ordeal tree, especially the bark, seeds and roots, contain powerful alkaloids and cardiac toxins. Historically, extracts from the bark were used in ordeal poison practices in parts of southern Africa, giving rise to the common name the ordeal tree. It's also been used in traditional medicine, but these practices carry substantial risk because the difference between a toxic and potentially therapeutic dose is extremely small. The symptoms include vomiting, tremors, irregular heartbeat and seizures, then respiratory failure and death. The second poison could be Bufoni distica, a bulb known across southern Africa for centuries, and Zulu herbalists were fully aware of its toxicity. Every part of that plant, especially the bulb, contained powerful alkaloids. It's highly poisonous to people, livestock and pets. Traditional healers have employed carefully prepared doses for medicinal and ceremonial purposes, but like the Swazi ordeal tree, there's a tight margin between a traditional dose and a dangerous one. Still, this bulb is highly sought after by modern collectors because of its beauty. Just wash your hands after fiddling with it, folks. The third possibility is the Acocantera, which causes death through cerebral hypoxia. And there's also a fourth, poison beans, the species of Abrus precatorius in particular, but those can take days to kill you, and Cetshwayo perished in less than 2 hours. Zibebu was immediately blamed, and he would, of course, pay eventually for his actions. But first, the king had to be buried. He was placed in a sitting position and tied to his hut's central post. The building was sealed with clay and mud so that no smell could emerge, and Cetshwayo's body was left there for a few weeks to putrefy. The royal attendants asked Melmoth Osborne for permission to take the body to Amakosini Valley so he could be buried with his ancestors, but the commissioner refused. He was afraid of the Usutu Amabutu appearing and then using the burial as a rallying call for action. Instead, a Christian convert called Hlamangana gave the royal house his wagon, and Cetshwayo was placed in a huge coffin, sitting upright. The wagon transported Cetshwayo deep into the Nkandla forest. He was buried on the Shezi's homestead belonging to Luhungu, the man who had provided him with his refuge before he headed off to Ishowe. The site is beautiful, in a valley below the rolling hills of Bobe Ridge. Hundreds attended, cattle were slaughtered. The chanting men and women pointed their sticks in the direction of Matlabatini, where the shades of the king's ancestor lived. Dinizulu Cetshwayo's son and heir was still a young teen. He was too young to stand at the graveside, or he would have seen his uncles there, and also seen the wagon, which had transported his father, broken down into pieces and laid over the grave. The king's remains lie there to this day, a sheltering grove nearby, as is the tradition. Sometimes the trees grew over the grave, and Luhungu's descendants watched over the grave still. As Cetshwayo lay dying, he is reported to have turned to his brother, Dabulumanzi, and told him that Dinuzulu, as his only surviving son, was his true heir.
Bring him up well. There is your task, Dabulumanzi. Look after my child.
Dabulumanzi wouldn't live long enough to follow through with Cetshwayo's command. He was shot by Boers, probably on the instigation of jealous brothers, in 1886. Other brothers were present at Cetshwayo's death. They too heard the dying wish. Indabuko, Zewedu, Singana, and Mnyamana, the chief counselor. But Cetshwayo's chief wife was pregnant, and if she bore a son, it would be superior to Dinuzulu, whose mother was Nomvimbi Mswele, a minor wife. So they gathered together and announced Dinuzulu was indeed their anointed heir. He would grow up as an intrepid and fiery man with an imperious temper and an excellent horseman, accurate with a rifle. As a young teen, he was already developing the thick thighs of his forebears like Dingana and Shaka and Senzanga Kona. Later, he would become stout like Mpande and grow a beard. But right now, he was a pimply youth, so Ndabuko and Mnyamana were appointed his official guardians and took control of the Usutu regiments. There was no hope of reconciling the Mantlakazi of Zibebu with the royal house. Zululand was riven by the division between these two houses. It was blood for blood. Many vested interests came to the fore, with the British supporting Zibebu clandestinely, while pretending to be the arbiter, the referee. Zibebu controlled most of Zululand north of the Mhlathuzi River, and the Usutu faced destruction. They were starving, and all attempts at convincing the British authorities to broker a truce between the Usutu and the Mantlakazi failed. A slew of younger chiefs who'd emerged after the carnage of the Battle of Mdini all had grown up with new technology. They could ride. They knew their way around rifles. They understood colonial attitudes, growing up with white traders and the British and settler culture. They had been hardened by the experience and all had a burning desire to crush Zibebu. They wanted to revenge their king. The Natal officials believed it was time to extend colonial power directly into Zululand, but the British government refused to sanction such an intervention. It was going to increase costs, and that wouldn't do in a political situation at home which was unstable. They would change their minds, as you're going to hear. The reserve between the Tugela River and the Mhlathuzi River was functioning well, a buffer zone between Natal and the dangerous northern Zululand area over the other side of the Mhlathuzi. As far as England was concerned, the Zulu would be left alone to destroy themselves. Which was a bit wicked, seeing that it was the British who had helped destabilize the region. The younger chiefs were having none of this and decided to embark on what was going to be a misconceived project. Sihayo, who had perished in the Battle of Mdini, would have done a double take had he been alive to see what his son Metlokazulu was up to. It was an irony because Metlokazulu means one in the eyes of the Zulu. Perhaps his ancestors would have supported his clever diplomatic moves, at least initially. Joining Metlokazulu was Ndabankulu, whose name could be translated as important affair, also alongside Ntombela. Seated across from these chiefs, Veldt-Coronet Jacobus van Staden and other Boers who lived on the South African Republic's border with northern Zululand. They had all responded to calls for assistance from Cetshwayo's Usutu in defending the cross-border region against Zibebu and his ally, Hamu. One of the most influential chiefs in the 1870s and 1880s, Hamu originally supported Cetshwayo Kampandi, then defected to the British during the 1879 war, and afterwards emerged as one of the principal chiefs of northwestern Zululand. His people occupied territory adjoining the Utrecht Boer frontier, making him an important intermediary in Boer-Zulu relations. The Boers agreed with these young chiefs. Dinuzulu should be formally recognized as Cetshwayo's successor, and they were willing to back up their words with their horses and their guns, unlike the British at that moment. All manner of geopolitical shenanigans were going on in 1884. The Boers weren't supporting Dinizulu out of the goodness of their hearts. They wanted land. And it had been Cetshwayo who'd warned the chiefs not to do a deal with the South African Republic Boers. They could not be trusted, and had lusted after Zululand for decades. Should the Boers enter the Zulu civil war on the side of the Usutu against Zibebu, their firepower was going to swing the balance away from the Mantlakazi, away from the preferred British chief. In exchange for defeating Zibebu, yes, the Boers would accept only one thing as payment. Land. Cetshwayo, like his ancestors, Mpande, and particularly Dingaan, had feared this moment, but the Usutu chiefs were desperate. Since September 1883, after Cetshwayo had been defeated at Ondini, the Boers had flooded over the border into the disputed territory around Utrecht and Vryheid, building houses, laying out farms, driving out the local inhabitants. Zibebu kept away from the Boers. He was concentrating his attacks on the coastal Zulu by this time. Coenraad Meyer and his friends were operating on the assumption that the British were unwilling to cross the Mhlathuzi to sort out the civil war, so it was in their interest to seize what they could in the meantime. It was Germany that was going to upend Meyer's plans. Dinizulu was living in Nkandla with Tabulumanzi when he was smuggled across the Mhlathuzi in April 1884 and popped up at the Boer farm near Bavani River in the Wakkerstroom district of the Suid-Afrikaanse Republiek. Soon word spread the heir apparent was going to spearhead a new Usutu-Boer alliance and for the Usutu in hiding across the territory. This was fantastic news. For the Mantlakazi, not so much. Back in Ishowe, Melmoth Osborne was growing nervous. This was not part of the plan, and his consternation turned to alarm when he heard that Tabulumanzi mustered over 2,000 warriors in Nkandla. The reserve territory carbineers marched out of Ishowe, the men highly disciplined, a well-armed force of black policemen under command of George Mansell and British officers. Tabulumanzi deployed traditional Zulu tactics against this force, and he paid the price, repulsed with considerable losses. Mansell, though, thought it advisable to return to Ishowe instead of continuing to pursue Tabulumanzi, and reinforcements arrived shortly afterwards from Natal. Some made their way north to Rorke's Drift, and rebellious chiefs were thus pacified. While all that was going on, Utrecht Landros Lucas Meyer put out a call for all Boers interested in an expedition into Zululand called the Committee of Dinizulu Volunteers to gather in town. The South African Republic, under Paul Kruger, later denied any knowledge of what was going on, publicly issuing statements of disavowal, but those were obviously merely to mollify the British. Soon a group of more than 100 men had gathered. Not all were Boers. There were Scots, British, and even German adventurers, attracted by the chance to earn land in exchange. One of these Boers would go on in life to achieve greatness, and he was Louis Botha, the future first ever Prime Minister of the Union of South Africa. But right now he was eyeing Zululand with some interest. These were not a rabble. These were regarded as rich farmers in search of more land and simultaneously intent on imposing their form of order on the northern Zululand region, racked as it was by Zulu civil war. Refugees had flooded into the ZAR, and the border regions were facing increased pressure, food shortages. Raiding became a common complaint. In May 1884, the commander set off along with Dinizulu, heading south, and a large lager was established between Hlobane and the Ngomi forest at Inyati Hill on the farm Zalfaga. It was at this lager of more than 70 wagons that the Usutu were going to negotiate their rights away to a vast swathe of Zulu territory in exchange for the defeat of their arch-enemy, Zibebu, a poisoned chalice. The royal line was so desperate and shattered they were willing to do a deal with men intent on seizing their land in exchange. While most Usutu chiefs reluctantly agreed to talk, one stood aside, Imnyamana, steadfast in his belief that any land exchange was wrong. He believed Zibebu's thousands of head of cattle could be the payment, but he was overcome by the majority. In a ceremony that was bizarre and strange, Dinizulu was proclaimed King of the Zulu on the 21st of May, 1884, by the Boers. Indobuko, Zwedu, and Shingana had ritually proclaimed him king the day before. Mnimana, though, stayed away, blaming ill health, but he was issuing a solitary protest against the idea. He knew that by indulging the Boers, his land was going to be chipped away, or perhaps more accurately, slashed away. 9,000 Zulu men, women and children gathered at the Zalfaga Lager, along with 350 Boers, at dawn on the 21st. After speeches and some displays of power from both the Boers and the Zulu, a midday ceremony took place. The Amabuto escorting Dinah Zulu were met by 50 mounted Boers, who led the procession to two wagons arranged to form a platform. An upended box had been placed on the wagons, and a blue and white flag flew behind. Symbolic? The Boers had flown a blue and white flag 45 years earlier when they had crowned Mpande. The burghers stood in two semicircular lines in front of their lager. Directly opposite them were 9,000 Zulus fronted by lines of dignitaries. A giant horseshoe of former enemies gathered in what suddenly became an extremely significant moment. The teenager Dinah Zulu clambered onto the wagons, onto the box, when four members of the Boer committee joined him. As John Labunt, the historian, points out, this was a somewhat tawdry affair, because the Boers were republicans. They had supposedly no place for monarchies, and here they were solemnly proclaiming a king. The proclamation was read out, confirming Dinah Zulu as lawful heir and successor of the late Cetewayo as king of the Zulu nation and of Zululand, in Dutch, and then translated into Zulu. Dinah Zulu kneeled, and the four Boers placed their hands on his head, swearing to protect him from his enemies, which, as you know, were both the Matlakazi and the English. Andreas Laas was one of these Boers, and he conducted one of the most sacred moments of the European tradition by anointing the head of the new king with castor oil, lacking the consecrated oil, the chrism commonly applied by a bishop. A roar rolled across the hillsides. Usutu, God save the king. 2 days later, Dinah Zulu met with the Boers once again and put his mark to a document which confirmed that the Boers bound themselves to him in return for a large tract of land. Big enough, it was said, to establish an independent self-government. It was Mnyamana's worst nightmare, that vague phrase. Hearing of the goings-on, Zibebu sent an urgent message to the British asking for assistance against the Dinah Zulu and the Boers. While the Natal settlers were amenable, the British government was not. Zibebu spurned Dinah Zulu, saying he was no king.
He is but a dog, and when he is hungry, he may come to me.
With the British declaring they were out of this fight, the Boers relished their new freedom and began preparing to advance into Mantlakazi territory. White traders who had established businesses in the Trans-Mhlathuzi region began withdrawing, realizing it was more prudent to be cautious at this moment. Some, though, stayed behind. They would pay for that. In June, the attacks began. 7,000 Usutu men, many emaciated from months of life as refugees in the caves and the forests, the swamps, joined by 120 Boers under the command of Lucas Meyer. This mixed force was opposed by only 1,000 Mantlakazi. Zibebu was outnumbered and outgunned, so he withdrew from his great place, Mangonomo, southwest of the Lebombo Mountains. He retreated northeastwards towards the mountains with his cattle and his people. The invading Usutu force reached the Vuna River on the 2nd of June and bivouacked at Msebe, close to the recent painful battle site where the Usutu had been overcome and defeated. It was revenge they sought, the humiliation of the recent destruction fresh as the skeletons that could still be seen lying amongst the rocks and the aloes. They marched past Bangonomo, following the barely flowing Mkuzi River, it was midwinter after all, into the flat and arid country 22 kilometers north towards the Mkuzi port, a gorge worn through the Lebombo Mountains by the river on its way to the sea. South of this gorge lies the jagged Gaza Mountain, further west Chaneni Mountain. As the Boers peered through their glasses at this point, it was apparent that a perfect ambush zone lay ahead, the mouth of the gorge. Commandant Lucas Meyer approached slowly, his 120 Boers joined by the Usutu force of 7,000, as they arrived at the squeeze point on the 5th of June. Zibebu had hidden his Catalan women and children north of the Mkuzi River, along a bush-covered spur above that river. The Mantlikazi regiment was based south of the Mkuzi, split into two detachments, who took shelter in the thick riverine bush and the tall trees. Zibebu's position was ideal, the broken plain in front covered with dense thorn bushes and rising rocky slopes up to Chaneni Mountain, difficult for mounted Boers to negotiate. A small detachment of Mantlakazi were placed in a deep donga which ran southeast down to the Mkuzi, with orders to attack the advancing Sotho and Boers and draw them towards the main Mantlakazi station behind. They would then outflank their attackers, pin them against the river, thus neutralizing their numerical advantage. A good plan, at least theoretically. But this was diamond cutting diamond, because his opponents were also Zulu. The Usutu commanders and the Boers knew full well what was probably going to happen, and as they approached the poort, they broke into their traditional two horns in a chest formation. Unlike Tetshwayo and Mpande, and even Dingana and sometimes Shaka, Dinizulu did not stay behind at home. He marched along with his Usutu regiments. Mamesi commanded the left horn. He was joined by 16 mounted Boers, and they moved along the river bank. The chest was led by Lucas Meyer, a unique moment in military history where a Boer commander led a traditional Zulu section. They were going to bear the brunt of fighting, heading directly towards the donga, in which the Mantlikazi no doubt lurked. The Usutu right horn marched across the donga higher up to the south. Zibebu now was in a bit of a pickle. Mamesi's left horn had confounded his plan because the Mantlikazi panicked and shots were fired, springing his trap too early. But he did have one thing in his favour, his troops' morale. The Usutu had been beaten so regularly by the Mantlikazi that the sight of Zibebu's well-fed warriors and their dreaded war cry of Washesha caused the Usutu to lose resolve. Many of Dinizulu's men turned to flee, but there was a long line of Boers behind them who fired a fusillade at the sprinting Mantlikazi, and in doing so, shot some of their own side. In the chaos, Dinizulu's men turned and stood fast, believing the Mantlikazi were the lesser of two evils, and Zibebu's attack suddenly withered. It was the moment the Usutu men had dreamed about, had spoken about, their blood chilled by years of being beaten, humiliated. As the Mantlikazi made way, heading towards the Mkuzi River and their families, Dinizulu's Xolusi regiment managed to cross the ridge ahead of them, and retreat turned into a rout. The slaughter was heavy along the river. The field of battle would soon be covered with skulls and bones, like the field of Msebe. But this time, it was not Usutu bones. It was Mantlikazi. Zibebu managed to escape on a sure-footed Boer pony across the Mkuzi and galloped up the slopes of the Lubombo Mountains. From there, he turned and he looked down on the scene of carnage, his legacy slashed and shot to pieces in front of his eyes. The victors spent the next 3 days rounding up 60,000 cattle and winkling hundreds of women and children out of their hiding places. These were all herded back south. The Boers made a great show of looting a few white traders' wagons, sending a message to all future merchants who dared enter Zululand. Remnants of the Mantlikazi made it as far north as Sambani's Nyao, the very people who had killed Dingaan, so Zibebu knew he was in real danger there. Eventually, a bedraggled man accompanied by two white traders, Grosvenor Dork and John Exley, rode into Ishowe to report a disaster to Melmoth Osborne. That was Zibebu, who was offered asylum in the reserve south of the Mhlatuzi, north of the Tugela, and here he led 6,000 men, women and children to the safety of a special location set aside for them near Inyoni. The proud warlord was now forced to beg grain from Melmoth Osborne to feed his starving people, a spectacle which warmed Usutu hearts. Their hearts were hardly warmed before the shock of what this victory really meant became glaringly apparent. The number of Boers demanding land for assisting Dinizulu climbed to 800, and soon the Zulu king was forced to concede over 1 million hectares for the establishment of a Boer state. That was going to be called the New Republic. And its first president was supposed to be Lucas Meyer, who quickly proclaimed its protectorate over the Zulu. This turned victory into defeat for the young king. It was the worst, most debasing moment ever suffered by the Zulu people. Far worse then Cetshwayo's defeat by the British. Wolseley's settlement had fractured Zululand, but the people still controlled their land. Now even the graves of Dinuzulu's ancestors were inside land assigned to the Boers. As we're going to hear, the British suddenly woke up to this crisis, not because of any emotional support for the Zulu, but because the Germans were scrambling for African land, and that was London's biggest fear. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platform and sign up for the newsletter at desmondlatham.blog. Until next, tot ziens.